Today we're going to continue in our series in 1 John called Certain. And just to give you a little insight into how these kinds of things come into being, a friend of mine in our diocese, Ed, from San Jose, he's the guy I bet about the World Series last year. Anyway, so Ed calls me and says, how do you come up with these ideas, these creative ideas for your sermon series? I said, well, Ed, I hate to burst the bubble here, but I look at the lectionary appoints readings in 1 John, and so I say, hey, we're going to do a series in 1 John. That's how it works. So here we are, 1 John. And today I want us to think about this, the fact that our ideas, what we believe, matters. It matters. You know, think about this. For many years, people thought the world was flat. There are many ancient depictions of the world as kind of this big disc, you know, floating in the atmosphere. And you think, well, so what? Who cares? You know, well, it's important to understand that if a person believed that the world was flat, then that impacted the way that they lived. For example, the people that thought that the world was flat were much less likely to explore because they literally were afraid that their ship was going to go, like, off the edge, you know? If you knew that the world was not flat, and there were people that knew the world was a sphere, I mean, way back before that was universally accepted, but the people that knew that the world was a sphere, it was round, and knew that their ship was not going to go off the edge, they tended to have a much greater spirit for exploration and adventure. And we know how significantly that spirit has impacted human civilization. So the point is, what we believe, the ideas that we hold, always impact the way that we live, for good or for bad. Deeply held ideas are not neutral. They always impact our behavior. And the early Christians, and certainly John the Apostle, no exception, they knew that this was the case. Many of the New Testament epistles were written to combat false teaching, bad ideas that were being spread among Christian communities. The early Christians, you know, they had very specific beliefs about Christ, and they were adamant that those in the faith not depart from those teachings. They knew that if beliefs changed, behavior would follow. Behavior would change. Now, last week we talked about John and the fact that he wrote this first epistle so that his flock would be certain that they would have assurance about eternal life that is found in Jesus. He gave them three tests so that they could know: the theological test about Jesus, the moral test about how we live, and the social test about how we relate to one another. Those were the three tests that would help people to be sure about their faith. Now, we would be wise to ask this question. Well, but why did John think that they needed this assurance? What was going on that made him think, you know, people in my flock are being disturbed and are starting to doubt their faith? What events were causing that to happen? And so we're going to go to school this morning and learn about some of these things that were going on that led John to write this letter. So we heard earlier, erroneous doctrines were being taught in the church. In that reading that Nancy did for us, there were teachers who were teaching things that were a departure from the message that John had preached to them about Jesus. These teachers who were teaching these false things were really stirring up, upsetting the community. And so this is one of the reasons why John wants to give them this theological test. What you believe about Jesus is going to help you to be sure about your faith. You know, in different places, John refers to these false teachers who have kind of stirred up the community. He refers to them as false prophets. He calls them deceivers. But in chapter 2, he refers to them as antichrists. These are people who are against Christ, and they deny Christ's essential nature. They really are denying who Jesus is. And so these teachings, again, were upsetting people's faith, causing them to doubt their faith, causing them to doubt eternal life. And so John writes his letter to counter that reality. So as we go forward this morning, I want to answer three questions. What was the specific nature of the heresy that John was opposing? What was it all about? What were they teaching? Two, how was that heresy manifested in the life of the church? And then three, why does it matter to us? You know, what difference does it make? So what was the nature of the heresy that John was opposing? To get at that, I want to go to 1 John chapter 4. John makes it clear in this verse and in others that Jesus is the God-man, that Jesus is human and divine. He is the God-man, the divine Messiah, the Son of God, who has come in human flesh. He says this, "By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God." And so John wants to make sure that his flock understands that Jesus is fully human and fully divine, and that they hold that tension together. That Jesus is both divine and human nature reconciled into one person. You know, there were different heresies in the early church, but one heresy was held by many Greek or Gentiles who had become Christians. And the nature of this heresy was that it was very difficult for them to accept that the Messiah could truly be a human being. Now, Jewish Christians, on the other hand, had the exact opposite problem. They had a hard time believing the Messiah could be God. But the Greek or Gentile Christians, it was just the opposite. They had a hard time believing that the divine Son of God, the Messiah, could be human. That didn't relate to them. It was difficult for them to understand. And that was primarily because their filter for life was Greek philosophy. And I want to just explain a little bit about this. Let's look at this slide. This is philosophy from Plato, and it lays out kind of a basic filter through which the Greeks and most of these Gentile Christians viewed the world. They viewed the world in two very distinct realities, the spiritual and the material. And they were completely separate. They did not intersect at all. Okay, there's no intersection at all between the spiritual and the material. The spiritual is where God is. It's eternal. It's beautiful. It's good. And the part of humanity that represents the spiritual is the soul. The material, the created order, is temporal. It's going away. It's ordinary, not beautiful. It's evil, not good. It's unredeemable. And the part of humanity that represents the created is the body, the physical body. So if that's the way you see the world, if that's the filter through which you see everything, Think about that. How can God, the divine Son of God, the Messiah, be a human? It was very, very challenging for them to understand. So this is the heresy that John is opposing. That the man Jesus was not the Messiah, the Son of God. That's what was being taught. And he writes this, "Who is the liar but he who denies that Jesus, the man Jesus, is the Christ?" So these antichrists were teaching that the man Jesus was not the divine Messiah, the Son of God. Now, the specific name of this heresy that came out of this Greek philosophy was called Gnosticism. Gnosticism. And that is from the Greek word gnosis, which means knowledge. Knowledge. And so these false teachers were claiming that salvation was not through Jesus, but salvation was through divine knowledge that was only given to a few. And guess who it had been given to? Yeah, the people who were claiming that they had it, of course. So you were saved by divine knowledge. And this divine knowledge that they had been given included the knowledge to know that Jesus the man was not the divine Messiah. So this is what they were teaching, and you can imagine it was really upsetting the Christian community, and it was causing a lot of confusion. So this Gnosticism, this heresy, it developed into various forms. One form led people to say this: Jesus was not human. He only seemed to be or appeared human. So somehow Jesus looked human and you could touch him and stuff, but he really, at the end of the day, he wasn't human. Another explanation that these antichrists came up with, or how to explain Jesus, they said, well, he was kind of human, but because the divine and the human nature can't really interact, the divine nature kind of came upon him at baptism and then departed him at the crucifixion. So they had these kind of bizarre theories. But the bottom line is, what they were perpetuating was the lie, according to John, that the man Jesus was not the divine Christ. So how was this heresy then manifested in the life of the church? Three ways. First, it caused division. It caused division. Clearly we see that those people who were teaching these erroneous doctrines had separated themselves from the community. So there was a split. Verse 19, they went out from us, but they were not of us, for if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But they went out, that it might become plain that they are all not of us. So one manifestation of this heresy was division. And division is always inevitable if you don't agree, right? If you don't agree on the essentials, division is almost always going to happen. And does that really matter? Is that important? Well, of course it is, because Jesus taught at great length that his followers should be one. But we can't be one if we're not unified at the most basic level about what we believe. The second heresy, our impact of the heresy, was that it led to a spiritual arrogance among the people who claimed to have this special knowledge. And that just makes sense, doesn't it? It's like, well, if only a few people have this special knowledge, then you by default feel like you're pretty cool because you have the special knowledge and no one else does. So those who were claiming this special knowledge looked down on everyone else, and their arrogance led them to treat their brothers and sisters, in ways that were not loving. And so that's why John writes, whoever says he is in the light, whoever says, you know, I've got this all figured out, I've got the divine knowledge, whoever says he is in the light but hates his brother is still in darkness. It doesn't matter what you claim if you're treating your brothers and sisters in disrespectful, ungodly ways. Then you're in darkness. Whoever hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness and does not know where he is going. So the heresy caused division, the heresy led to spiritual arrogance, and the heresy also led to an indifference to righteous living. The people who were promoting this heresy that Jesus, the man, was not the Messiah, their philosophical assumptions about this great divide between the spiritual and the material, it led them to not really care about how they lived. Now, follow me on this one, because this is really actually, you know, you admire in some ways the cleverness of this, even though it's just dead wrong. So in that system, you know, the spiritual is good and the material is bad, evil. And so that led some of these Gnostic antichrists, it produced in them a faith that put such a high value on spiritualism, being spiritual, right? It put such a high value on being spiritual that what happened in the body, what happened in the material realm, well, it really didn't matter. It was insignificant. One sect of Gnostics, they were called the Cainites. They even went as far to teach that indulgence in sin was a key to salvation. Because since the body is evil, we had an obligation to defile it. Okay? Others suggested that they really weren't even sinners because sin was only real in the material realm and not the spiritual, and therefore what happened in the body really didn't count. Doesn't matter. Now, that sounds kind of crazy to us, perhaps, but I want to tell you, people still believe this stuff. I had an encounter with a guy my freshman year at the University of Alabama, and his name was Stan, and we ended up trying to evangelize each other to our differing belief systems, and, you know, when he was telling me this stuff, I had never really encountered it before, but he told me flat out that the material realm was not real. It didn't exist. And so I remember I held up my fork. We were eating lunch. And I held up my fork and I said, is this fork real? And I'll never forget his answer. It was brilliant. He said, no, it's not. He said, only the utility derived from using the fork is real. I was like, whoa, okay, all right. And then, so then I said, so if I take this fork and stick it in your hand, it won't hurt because it's not real. He had no response to that. I did ask him about suffering and sin, and he said, those are simply illusions of the material world. So in other words, just like the Gnostics, they don't really count. It doesn't matter. Well, the Apostle John disagrees. He rejects these ideas just completely. What happens in the body is not insignificant. That's why John says in chapter 2, verse 3, and by this we know that we have come to know him. So they claim, right, we know him. We have special knowledge. He says this, we know we have come to know him if we keep his commandments. See, if we actually live it out in our bodies. In chapter 1, verse 10, he states emphatically that our sin is indeed real. He says, if we say we have not sinned, we make God a liar, and his word is not in us. What we believe matters, and this heresy, this denial that the divine Christ was also fully human, it led to division in the church. It led to spiritual arrogance and unrighteous living. So let's conclude with our final question. So what? Why does it matter to us? I think there are many lessons from John's letter and the problems that were being caused by these antichrists in his word. But one thing that stands out to me is the importance of staying focused on the fundamentals. You know, it's not really any different today. We do not lack for teachers who want to take Christians onto matters of, you know, greater revelation and even more importance, like things that go beyond the scriptures. And we need to be very careful about those who claim to have special revelation or some sort of deeper insight that, you know, not many other people have been able to figure out. Instead, we should stay focused on the fundamentals of Jesus Christ, the God-man, fully God, fully human. And that's why John gives us that theological test. That Jesus, the man Jesus, is the Christ. The second thing I think that we can take from this is, you know, this heresy of the supremacy of knowledge is as alive today in our culture as it ever was. I mean, think about it. You know, they were saying that you're saved through knowledge. By having special knowledge. Doesn't that sound familiar? Isn't that the mantra of our culture? Don't we proclaim that knowledge, that education is the answer to every ill? I mean, surely knowledge is a good thing. There's no doubt about that. We're called to love God with our minds. But don't we need to acknowledge that even if we know the right thing to do, we will likely not do it. There is a world full of evidence that makes that abundantly clear. You know, focusing on knowledge really does not get to the root of our problem. And I think we would be wise to learn from John and from the other biblical writers that there's a deeper problem, and the problem of sin that is deeper in us is not solved simply by knowing. I think John would suggest to us that our deeper problem is a problem of rebellion against God and what he has laid out for us to do. And focusing entirely on knowledge as the remedy to that problem is only a band-aid that will never get to the root of sin. And then the last thing I think that this says to us in general is that, you know, the errors of John's day were simply an accommodation to the prevailing attitudes and beliefs of the culture that they were a part of. I mean, that's really what it was. These were not bizarre ideas to them. These were the basic cultural assumptions that the church lived in. And so I think we would be wise to recognize that that was not unique to their day. Of course not. The church is always challenged by the world, either to confront or to absorb the culture, you know, to be squeezed into the culture's mold. I think there are a variety of examples of that in our day. One primary example is the danger of reflecting the individualism of our culture. That's why we so often base our judgments in the church. We base our judgments and conduct on personal feelings and our experience rather than on the objective revealed truth of God. It's why we are conditioned, I think, to subjectivism rather than the objective realities of God and His Word. There are many examples, but the important thing is that we remain steadfast in our resistance to just simply accept all the winds of doctrine that our prevailing culture has blowing through it. Rather, we can be certain about our faith by staying firmly rooted in Jesus Christ and His Word that teaches us that He is the eternal Son, the firstborn of all creation. He is the divine Messiah who took on human flesh. He is the one who died and rose again. He is the head of the church, the author of our salvation, and He will come again, and His kingdom will have no end.